Hi there. We hope you find this episode interesting and helpful for mental health. Just a heads up that we're going to cover some difficult stuff, including sexual abuse. We've included links to support and resources in the show notes. So do what you need to look after yourself. Reach out to those you feel safe with. Thanks for listening.
I love the fact that our Shabbat morning services begin with the two parallel blessings of the gift of our body and the gift of our soul, that actually that interplay between our physical health and our own mental health, our resilience, our courage, our bravery, whatever it is that we're looking for from our mental health at that point, that we acknowledge every week that interplay.
Rabbiting on, rabbiting on.
Happy New Year. Lovely to be back with you all. Happy New Year. A greeting feels like a poignant way to open this episode of Rabbiting On. It's something we just say, isn't it? Happy New Year. But what do we really mean by it? Maybe we can unpack some of those feelings and emotions as we go through our episode today. So I'm Rabbi Robin Ashworth-Steen, and I'm here as always with Rabbis Debbie Young-Summers and Miriam Berger. And we're really excited to have some expert help here today. We're joined by Sharon Daniels, who's the Movement for Reform Judaism's Head of Safeguarding and Wellbeing, and someone that I know all three of us talk to and use regularly in our day-to-day roles. We've got used to starting our podcast with a question. So we're going to ask a question of each of us to help us get into the space and slowly start to unpack mental health and what that means for us in communities. So our question is, how is everyone feeling? Sharon, why don't you start? How are you feeling today?
Morning. Thank you for having me. It's lovely to be joining you. I am feeling somewhat refreshed from having a little bit of time off over the holidays and having got away to the Cotswolds to be able to just be out of the house and walk somewhere different and be away with my family. So that was really lovely. And also somewhat drained from the last month of uncertainty and unpredictability, particularly around running camp with RSY and whether we'd be able to go ahead or not go ahead, particularly as it was not till the end of December. So there was a lot of speculation that there would be restrictions after Christmas. And amazingly, we did it and we had a great time. Nearly 200 young people had a brilliant time. So that's really makes it all worthwhile. But it was, you know, a really, really stressful build up. So it's taken a bit of a toll. But really lovely that so many people had a good time, including my daughter. So that's worthwhile.
Thanks, Sharon. I really feel that the two things that you spoke about, the refreshed after the holiday, I feel exactly the same, and the exhaustion of holding that all and will we get away, will we not get away, and then coming back into a world that is still very uncertain, this happy new year. So I think I would say I would build on what you've said for my feeling, and I feel a bit discombobulated. I feel a bit ungrounded because of it all, trying to kind of deal with all the different emotions. Miriam, how are you doing today?
Well, clearly the Cotswolds was the place of choice this winter. I do feel that just having a couple of weeks of real downtime, like it feels like it's the time of year where everything goes quiet. When I was very, very involved in Limud, I used to give my dad a really hard time that he wouldn't come and present at Limud, even when I was programming chair. And he always used to say, but you know, it's only over Christmas and New Year that things ever go properly quiet in the Jewish community. And now I understand what he means. Like it does go quiet, even it seems, when Christmas and New Year fall on Shabbat. So I was, just grateful to get some real downtime and was really lovely to get a number of text messages the day that winter camps finished from lots of parents so thrilled that their kids had had such a great time on camp as well. So a great thank you to RSY.
Gorgeous. So lots of gratitude. Lovely. Mm-hmm. Debbie, how are you feeling today?
So I'm kind of embracing the more Jewish approach to New Year. And I think I'm feeling lots of guilt stuff, which is really fascinating. I was taken out by COVID over the break. And I think actually having a positive COVID test in and of itself makes you feel guilty. Like, where have I been? Who have I been in contact with? Who have I put in danger? Even though I, you know, test almost, you know, at that point, I was actually testing almost every day, but regularly test every other day anyway. So there's this sort of strange guilt feeling, and then also the guilt of having sort of saved up time with the kids for the holidays. You know, I often feel guilty that I'm not around at bedtime and I'm, you know, doing other things. And the holiday time was their time, and they really lost it. So there's all this sort of strange guilt stuff that I think I'm consciously working to not embrace in 2022. So, yeah, I think it's interesting to have guilt stuff appear at the Gregorian New Year when it's such a theme for the Jewish New Year. I'm still tired after COVID, but glad, so, so glad that I had it now and not, you know, earlier. I'm triple vaccinated, and other than exhaustion, really didn't suffer symptoms, and just feel really grateful that I was able to have COVID whilst vaccinated and whilst having a safe home to isolate in.
Yeah. Gosh, lots of gratitude for that. And also really hearing that, it's funny, we hold guilt all the time, don't we, as Jews and humans. Brené Brown, who's one of my guru go-to teachers, talks about the difference between guilt and shame, and how sometimes guilt can help us tap into what we need and what our values are. And shame is its kind of awful cousin, where you end up thinking, well, I'm a bad person, therefore I'm a bad mother or a bad rabbi, and that fine line between the two. And maybe that brings us on to why we're here today, particularly because it's Mental Health Shabbat, which starts tonight. And it's a chance, really. And I don't know, I already feel better having heard you all name the things that I'm feeling. It's really like, oh, it's not just me. It's everyone feels the same thing. So, Sharon, why don't you tell us a little bit about Mental Health Shabbat? What's it about? Why do we do it? Why do we need it?
So Jamie, which is the Jewish Community's organisation for mental health, instigated Mental Health Shabbat. I think it's been going for about 7 or 8 years. And really, it's based around Parshat Bo, which is the Parsha where we read about the plague of darkness. So that's why it links in. And it also happens to fall at this time of year, which is the time of year that a lot of people find hard. I think it's the third Monday in January, which is dubbed Blue Monday. That's the hardest day of the year when people haven't been paid because they got paid earlier in December, and people haven't got things to look forward to. The excitement of all the social events that happened in December are gone, and it's dark, the days are short, and it's difficult for people. So it ties in nicely that that's when we're reading the parasha. And really, it's about raising awareness. You know, so many communities, I know most of the Reform communities are doing something to mark it, to raise awareness for mental health, for us to understand that mental health is something that we all have. And that's something that's really shifted over the past 10 years or so. I mean, I've been working for RSY and Reform Judaism. It's 11 years this week, actually. And when I started, it was 3 hours a week. And it was really, you know, there's someone who's got a something on their application form, on their medical form, and you sort that out, and the rest of us will just get on with what we're doing. And that's how it started. And it's grown to a full-time job, because actually we realise now that everybody has well-being and mental health needs. We all need to think about that, and everything we do needs to be considering what the impact is on well-being and mental health. So it's not just about supporting the people who need a bit more help, it's about everybody. It's about how do we do getting to know you games in RSY, how do we do welcoming in synagogue, how do we phone people and make people feel part of a community, all the things that we do day to day that really are about well-being, and that's what community is about. So in a way, the journey that I've had in my job has reflected the journey of mental health and well-being in the community and in wider society around what it is and how important it is.
It's fascinating, isn't it, to think about how things have changed in such a short amount of time, even over the last 2 years, really, in terms of naming it. And as you said, your role and the name shifting, safeguarding and well-being. Before we kind of unpack a bit more about what mental health means and roles of communities, what do you do in your specific role then around well-being, and maybe just unpacking what safeguarding particularly means as well?
Well, I'll start with maybe on the well-being side. MRJ, Movement for Reform Judaism, we work mainly to work with and support and bring together the wealth of knowledge and experience that there is in our communities. So we have a Communities That Care initiative network. During the pandemic, we met every week because that's what people needed. We're meeting about 3 or 4 times a year now. Last year, we met every couple of weeks, and really bring together communities, the people who are caring in communities, the care coordinators, to share their knowledge, their experiences. They can ask each other questions. We can support that. We can bring in experts who can provide more knowledge, more information, so that we're really, really well equipped in our communities to be reaching out to the membership. We also have a honeycomb project, which we started this year, which we're working together with LJ. Thanks to a really great donation, we've been able to up the level of training that we're offering. And it's coming from a really, really Jewish place, the training. So we have a 6-part training for care volunteers. And each session is based on a piece of Jewish text. And it's based on chavruta learning, of learning in pairs or in small groups and discussing and asking questions. So the topics that we normally come to in care training, like being present with people, listening to people, also confidentiality and safeguarding, come from looking at a text and then talking about that. And what does Judaism say about these things? So it's a really different course. So whatever people are coming into it from, then they've got something new to learn because it's a different perspective on it. People are interested. There are still a couple of places. The next cohort starts on Sunday. It's going to be on Sunday mornings. We try and run it at different times.
What do you hope that people come out of Honeycomb with? What's the goal for those people who undertake the training?
I think the goal is that they feel more prepared, they feel more confident in what they're doing. I think when we've done volunteer training, lots of people come in thinking, well, if I'm going to be phoning people in my community, I might be visiting someone in my community or giving them a lift to hospital or dropping some shopping in. That's just common sense. I know what I'm doing. And actually, when people do the training, they think, oh, I hadn't thought about that. And I hadn't really thought about that. They realize both the complexities of it, but also the power of what we're doing, that it's never just dropping off some shopping. There's always that opportunity to touch bases, to connect with somebody, to give somebody more than those little bits that we think we're offering. So I think it's both sides to look at the power of it and the complexities of it, and make sure that what we're offering in the best possible way and the safest possible way as well, in terms of safeguarding. And then during the pandemic, we've also offered some services direct to members. So we've had a bereavement support group that's been running since April 2020, which has been really, really successful in bringing people together who were bereaved during the pandemic, who lost the opportunity to have a lot of the rituals that are so important that Judaism does bring to bereavement. So people who weren't able to attend funerals, who didn't have a shiva in person, maybe didn't have a shiva online either, because right at the beginning that was difficult, or perhaps they were also ill and didn't have the opportunity to connect with people, to have visitors, and also when they started to want to go out, weren't able to. So it wasn't just you could meet a friend for coffee, because that wasn't really allowed. So it was really difficult. So bringing those people together has been really, really important, and able to offer that to people across the country because it's on Zoom. So some people in really small communities who wouldn't have had the opportunity to have that through their synagogue. And I know that group's really connected well. They're all in touch with each other outside of the group. And in fact, I think what they give to each other now is much, much more than what we're giving them in the hour that we meet once a week. And we've also had a group which we started during the pandemic, which started as talking about dying, when death and our own mortality was very, very high on everyone's agenda. We were really thinking about that and watching things on the news. But that's also been really good. And the group actually renamed it Talking About Living, because it's really about how we live with uncertainty, how we're living through these times, how life is changing, how people's priorities are changing. And again, the group have really connected and been able to support one another through this difficult time, with people coming from very different backgrounds, experiences, geographically. And both groups have been wonderful to be able to run with brilliant volunteers that we've had from our communities who came forward to help.
Really interesting. I feel when work that we do feels like, well, we're just doing it because we're community, and this is the sort of, this is what we need to provide as community, and things that feel deeply Jewish. And a lot of this work feels like it's right on that cusp of, could any community do this? Should any group of people be offering this kind of support? Yes. But what makes this inherently Jewish? And there's something around the psychology of the rabbis creating ritual around illness, bereavement, that actually at the foundations of Judaism is an understanding that these moments need support and ritualizing for our own mental health. That so there's a direct link between ritual and mental health.
Can we just clock that? I think, Miriam, your rabbinic thesis was about healing prayers, and you're the expert on this. Would I be right in remembering that?
And my thesis certainly was, but it came from a place of a negativity. So when I was studying in Israel the year before I started at Leo Beck, I was at HUC, and it was my first experience really of being within services that contained healing prayers, apart from at the sort of big URJ biennial moments. And it was just at that time that my mum had first been diagnosed with cancer. And so a lot of the American rabbinic students immediately jumped to support me by adding her name onto those lists for healing. And it felt really, really difficult because my connotations of lists of names in services was only at Kaddish. And I obviously did not want that association. You know, I was very much in the mindset of my mum would get through this, my mum would be well, and yet I was hearing her name in a way that I could only associate with death and Kaddish. And so it led to a whole journey of, you know, what is the place of healing prayers? Why do we include them? You know, a couple of years later, and I was back in England sitting next to my brother in services, who would kind of hiss at me during healing prayers that had then been slowly brought into British Jewish communities, where he'd be like, I can't believe you're joining in with this. It doesn't work, you know, and that kind of, you know, this, what is the place of them? And how do we have prayers for healing when, you know, we've got people with long-term conditions whose, you know, do their names appear week after week? What does it mean when it's not physical, when it's a mental health issue? I think for me, prayers for healing open up a whole piece around what is community for, rather than necessarily what is prayer for.
I think it goes back to something Sharon was saying before about the normalizing of having feelings and emotions. I do think that in the world that we live in, or often I find the world that I live in, kind of tries to make me separate the body and soul that I am to just being like a worker or, you know, just doing things. And I often kind of either feel ashamed or shouldn't be having feelings and emotions, but normalizing them. And the healing prayer is a great way of doing it. And I often add in, when we do it at Jackson's Row, healing for the parts of us that are in need of healing as well, so that you're able to say for yourself that you need a moment of healing. And I know that regularizing that, and I can see it with Gabriel. So we're quite emotionally literate now in our household, and I wasn't when I was a kid or a teenager. I had no sense of being able to name what my feelings were or emotions. And Gabriel has a wealth of vocabulary, partly through synagogue, and he'll say to me, oh, I like it when you go around and ask people for their names, that interactive moment for healing as well. And it's for me, it feels really important. And Sharon, you mentioned RSY at the beginning about being able, when you're young, to step into those rituals and also that language of emotions. And I'm sure, I know that RSY also takes this on board, doesn't it, and teaches and helps people on camps and everything to be able to engage in that way.
Yeah, I'm really trying to think about how we educate, both in RSY and also with the cheders, with the Sunday schools that we have in our communities, or how we use, again, using the Jewish opportunities to think about how we educate and develop emotional literacy, which I think is really, really important. Aylith Nursery use a really amazing program called Bounce Back from Australia, where they look at fairy tales and stories that we talk to our children about, which are quite bizarre stories. I remember being there when they were talking about the three little pigs. You know, it's such a bizarre story, isn't it? But actually, they took out a lot of emotional messages. You know, how does the wolf feel and how does the pig feel? And what could the pig say to the wolf when the wolf comes? And really, we've talked about that idea quite a lot and looked at that program and thought, well, we can do the same with the stories that we have. And when we look at the story of Purim, when we look at the story of Jonah, maybe for Yom Kippur, who was stuck in a dark place, who was asked to do something he didn't want to do, those are all challenges that we might feel in our lives. What could he have done? And that sort of slightly depersonalizing it by talking about what Jonah could have done rather than what do we do when we're asked to do something we don't feel comfortable with. But what could Jonah do? That makes it a little bit easier for young people to discuss it. So we've done some work, I know, when Debbie was at MRJ with the Cheder teachers, to think about how they can use that sort of program to really bring emotional literacy into the classroom in Cheder for those youngest children. And we try and do that with RSY as well. And also really thinking about the fact that when we teach children about physical health, we don't talk to them about diabetes and heart disease. We talk to them about staying well. We talk to them about eating healthily, five a day, getting some exercise. And that should be the same for mental health, that we're not talking to them about depression and anxiety. We're talking about what do we do to keep ourselves mentally well. So again, that message of eating healthily, mindfulness, maybe taking time out, writing a gratitude journal, talking about your problems, those are the positive things that we're encouraging young people to do for their mental well-being, rather than educating about conditions. So those are kind of two ways that we've really worked to improve the education we're offering. And then we also offer mental health first aid training to people who are working with young people to feel more confident. It's an international evidence-based program so that people feel more confident that they're saying the right things, because sometimes we don't really know what to say in those moments. And it's really good that we are given those tools. Often people come on it and feel really assured that they're doing the right thing rather than having learned lots of new things. They think, actually, my instincts were right, but it's good to be grounded in some evidence as well. So lots of different levels of education. But it is really important, as you say, Robin, that we're developing emotional literacy. And that happens at home. But if we can do that in communities as well, that's really helpful.
I think one of the strengths of Judaism for me, going back a little bit to what Miriam was saying, has always been around rituals of grief particularly, and the fact that our rabbis, I think, in creating these structures and rituals really understood the need to show what we're feeling and to be given permission to feel what we're feeling. From kriya, the ripping of your clothes, it's this kind of public declaration of your inner brokenness, to, you know, putting the earth into the grave, it makes it so real that you have to feel it. You can't pretend this isn't happening. You know, we don't sanitize death at all. It's very kind of raw and real, and you're given space and time to gradually re-enter the world. I don't know if this has been an experience for you guys too, but over the last year, I've been really conscious of how many people have apologized for crying at funerals, which I find an astonishing sort of learning moment, really. To be able to say to people, that's what you're meant to be doing, that's what this is for, and just giving us permission to feel what we're feeling. And it sounds like so much of the work that you're doing, Sharon, is almost expanding that beyond grief and death, and to give us all permission to feel what we're feeling and to understand how to navigate that in the world that we live in.
Yeah, and Miriam actually did a really good session for Honeycomb, didn't you, for bereavement, of how the rabbis got it really right with that year and how that links into some of the theories around bereavement.
We did an interesting piece of learning at the beginning of the lockdown with online services, that people didn't need to turn their cameras off to cry during services, that actually that being able to be oneself within the context of displaying emotions is really important. And it's why, for me, I love that Jamie choose Parashat Bo as their week, their parasha for mental health awareness. Because I think so much of Jewish community's role is acknowledging that we spend a lot of time in the darkness. And the community's role is almost turning on the torch for different people, handing people their little spotlight and being able to say, whatever it is that causes you to feel the darkness at this time, let us hand you the kind of the flaming torch, the thing that says, bring yourself into the light. Let us know that you're there so that we can walk this journey with you. And that hopefully we become a community of people holding torches in the darkness. We can't get rid of the darkness, but we can illuminate ourselves and each other.
I think I am completely with you why Bo is the perfect portion for this. And it gives us, again, adding on to the ideas of light and darkness and being alongside both and knowing that we need and we'll go through both. I read a beautiful piece by Rabbi Sarah Davidson Berman, which is it's also online. You can find it. Maybe we could put it in the show notes, about personal plagues and what it feels like when the frogs are upon us, like that kind of itchy, feeling overwhelmed, kind of anxiety, the panic mode of it. To go through each of the 10 plagues of like how it feels in your body and how they're different modes of being. And often in community, we've spoken about the modes. So Tisha B'Av, when we get to Tisha B'Av, not only is it a moment, a season in the calendar, it's a season of life. And I often have congruents going, I'm having my personal Tisha B'Av at the moment, right? Because life doesn't align with the calendar in that way. It's not like, for this day, I'm going to feel more. And this day I'm going to go and feel happy. But actually, within Judaism, there are modes of beings and ways of being able to express. And we're very lucky, I think, that all of our ancestors recorded in the Torah are incredibly emotionally expressive beings. Some of them maybe aren't as in tune with their emotions as they can be or act out. But that's great because we get to see ourselves on the page, like, you know, Moses getting really angry and striking the rock in fury. Like, we've all been there when we've raised our voices too loud or screamed and thought, oh, that wasn't my best self, or Abraham like weeping for Sarah, that like permission that we're given to weep as well. I find that that kind of language and the symbols really helpful for when I actually can't express how I'm feeling, just to be able to say, this feels like a plague of boils. If I'm really, that would be a particularly awful one to be feeling. But often, you know, you do wake up on a day and just think, oh, this is how I'm feeling, and it's just horrendous. And that's what community can do, is it gives it and Judaism gives it containers. And I was thinking, you know, the 5 steps of well-being for NHS they give, I can't remember them all off the top of my head, but one's like connect with people, learn new skills. They're all about being in community. Like if you were to really enter into community fully, you'd probably get those 5, and it gives you that container, that home by it. And B is like a container, Bate is like a container for some of this, to be able to give a bit of safety as well. And that's the power of, I think, where communities can step in as with all of this stuff.
I suppose one of the challenges of all of this, though, is that we know that faith and religion and community can also be a cause of pain. We've seen in the last week, really, the impact of a particular case within the Haredi community of Chaim Walder, who was clearly guilty of child sex abuse. And his own funeral after he took his own life last week was attended by, you know, hundreds of supporters, it seemed. At the same night, the funeral took place of one of his victims who also took her own life and seemed to have a fairly small attendance. And just the conversation now that's going on in the Jewish world around supporting victims and knowing that as a community, there is pain caused, and how we can also be part of supporting those who've been hurt. It's really, you know, important conversation, I think.
It's really important that we hear those voices in our communities, that we listen, that we believe people first and foremost, because that's something that definitely isn't taken for granted and hasn't happened sometimes. So we absolutely need to be listening to people, being open to hearing people, giving people a voice and offering people support, and also acknowledging where the support that we can't offer and making sure we signpost people to organisations that can offer that support. We do work quite closely with Jewish Women's Aid, for example, making sure that people have the support they need and are able to begin some journey of healing, and also proactively really making sure that our communities are safe spaces, that we are really thinking about what do we do to make it as safe as possible. I think, again, like the journey we've gone on with mental health, we have a really different understanding of abuse and safeguarding now than we did 10 years ago. And that's a learning curve that we're all on and a journey we're all on together. But really thinking that it's not just, you know, what if a child tells you something bad is going on at home, but so many other places where young people and so many different ways in which people can be abused, that we need to be much more open to hearing and to thinking in different ways and to picking up, even recognizing when there's a problem, so that we can pass that on and make sure that person gets the support they need, and also the action is taken against the alleged perpetrators as well, that that's looked into properly, that we use the legal system that we have in this country, that that's absolutely the first port of call that we would go to for something that's important as safeguarding.
Aaron and Debbie, you're both kind of walking the journey with me with Wellspring as well, and what does it mean to create within the British Jewish community a place specifically to hold people through difficult psychological journeys, and to have a space where we can use ritual as a way of being able to say, how do we live with these experiences that we have had in our lives, not wash them away with mikveh, but be able to say they have their place in my life, but they don't need to rule my life, and that they can be contained in the same way as Judaism teaches us that our grief, though ever present, is contained within the rituals that we create for it.
Yeah, I think the privilege of being able to work with people on rituals of any kind, but particularly in the mikveh, because it's such a private space, and Jewishly we don't have a lot of those, right? Everything is about community and food and tables and being together, and actually that ritual of processing and transitioning and giving space to tears, because the mikveh, you know, just absorbs those tears, it becomes part of the mikveh, I think is so, so powerful.
And that so many of our greatest issues that affect our mental health have very physical connotations with our body as well, whether it's about people and relationships and how that's impacted our body, or whether it's about our physical health and the impact that that's had on our mental health. There's all sorts of ways that actually by creating such a physical ritual, it can support our mental health as well. I mean, I love the fact that our Shabbat morning services begin with the two parallel blessings of the gift of our body and the gift of our soul, that actually that interplay between our physical health and our own mental health, our resilience, our courage, our bravery, whatever it is that we're looking for from our mental health at that point, that we acknowledge every week that interplay.
And Dame Cecily Saunders, who founded the hospice movement, talked about physical and emotional, but also social and spiritual. And those, you know, why do we wait till people are terminally ill to think about people in that holistic way? Like the Jewish community obviously brings that spiritual element to it as well. The rituals, whether it's the mikveh or the other rituals that we have around difficult times and prayer. So we're bringing all that together, and the social, that people are never on this journey alone. And sometimes that social can be for a positive impact, hopefully, but also sometimes that social context is also negative, that there may be judgment, there may be disbelief. So it's really important that we're harnessing all four of those areas and thinking about people really, really holistically and bringing together the physical, the spiritual, the social and the emotional to really understand people well and give people the support and the care that they need. I'd be really interested to know how you as rabbis all look after yourselves when you're holding so much for your congregants, for all the people you support and all the emotional issues that you are faced with day to day. How does that pan out for you in terms of your well-being, and what do you do to look after yourselves?
It's a really important question, actually. I remember at Leo Beck College, we were offered the opportunity of sort of subsidised therapy, and I took that and appreciated it. I do remember one of our colleagues, who I won't name, saying that she would rather the college subsidised her weekly manicures than therapy, because that was more important for her mental health and her sense of relaxation. And actually, I have taken that on board a little bit. I've now tried to schedule a sort of fortnightly visit to a friend who's a beautician who does do my nails, because it means I have to put my phone down. It is my day off anyway, but you know, I put my phone down. I can only chat to this gorgeous human in front of me, and it's kind of something totally different and separate from the rest of my time and space. I'm also part of a rabbinic support group that are wonderful, but quite often I think the answer would probably be chocolate.
Fair enough.
I find, and I'm sure loads of people share this, that I throw so much at being able to function during the day. Like, for me, being human and being a rabbi, it's hard. So I have loads of strategies, too many to go on now, but I have therapy, I have a coach, I have an amazing rabbinic mentor who is currently under me on the screen, Miriam, great colleague, so I can ask lots of different questions to all of the time. And again, normalize, you know, the sense of that is really hard. Yeah, I've been through that or whatever it is. I try and exercise regularly. I have time where I sit and read. I have reminders to, you know, stretch and move, and often use Jewish liturgy a lot, particularly in moments of distress. Like certain phrases or prayers come and I'll say them, little mantras. That's the beauty of the kind of the texts that we have, is that I've got gorgeous, one of my go-to mantras is the end of Adon Olam, Biyadoaf Giruchi, you know, in your hand I lay my soul. And that will just, you know, what a piece of poetry to have in a moment of feeling overwhelm or stress. So, I mean, I could go on for the whole episode, but I throw a lot at just being, you know, waking up and then going to bed in a peaceful way. And the last thing to say is, following on from what Miriam was saying earlier, we've got so many amazing Jewish rituals, so I often try and make those as mindful as possible. So Friday night candles in our family, we always, when we're bringing in the light with our hands, always say, what else, what other light do we want to bring in? What choices, what are we bringing in? What do we need from this Shabbat? And it might be rest. Gabriel often says a good football result. That's fine. And whatever it is, but really trying to be mindful in those moments of, oh, actually, what do I need? Slowing down to ask that question.
So Robin's going to make me look really bad in my answer because I don't have any of those strategies. But I think I learnt a number of years ago how really lucky I am, and to be able to find that and to be able to whatever is going on and however stressed and busy and whatever the weight on the shoulders of like the distress that other people are going through, to be able to say, actually, it's a privilege to be able to hold them at that moment, and for it not to be my own sadness, my own devastation, my own sorrow at that point, and that I'm walking somebody else's journey with them. And even at times where, you know, life is not as wonderful as it could be, to be able to actually stop and say, but look how lucky I really am. And I think, you know, these last couple of years have really shown me that, you know, my life is so much easier and less complicated than so many other people's. And I'm so fortunate in what I do have that it doesn't take much to, you know, to find I've had a very stressful day and I'm in crying with tears in hysterics, you know, before Ben goes to bed because of, you know, something he said or something we've done, and just to find that lightness in the real immediacy and just to be able to say, actually, I'm really lucky, and please God, may I always feel like I can say that.
That's so powerful, isn't it? Because there are the two things that are all, and it's more than two, but that are alongside each other, which is the darkness, the grief, the pain, whether it's ours or someone else's. And I know for me, I have to give space to that, because if I try and turn away from it or ignore it or deny it, just like the midrash of the frogs, there's a midrash that the plague of frogs, there was just in the Torah, it says one frog came up and the rabbis are like, why only one? And they say, well, the Egyptians saw it and were so terrified that they started slashing at it and the frog multiplied, and that's where the plague came from. So I know that if I like don't delve in and sit with my darkness, sadness, grief, anger, whatever it is, it will just multiply. And alongside that, doing exactly as you said, Miriam, actually, here's the gratitude and here's the beauty. Really, because of the darkness, I can see the beauty and the life even more acutely than I could do before.
It's why I love the fact that we're given these morning blessings. You know, there's a list of them in the Siddur, in the Reform Movement Siddur over on page 164. But actually to be able to recognize them as a list of, you know, we use the phrase counting our blessings, but actually what does it mean to take a moment and to think sort of what is our blessing for this week? What is that prayer that we need to be able to take out and to rely on? And so I wondered if as part of this conversation, actually one of our blessings for this week, as we acknowledge what it means to be able to be grateful to God for supporting our human steps, whether that is the divine or those people that we bring around us, what does it mean to give thanks for those people who walk life's journey with us, and to be able to feel that whether we experience it or whether it's an aspirational, that we're asking to feel the closeness of somebody or something to walk with us through each of our steps. So the blessing, the end of the blessing is Hameichin Metzadeh Gavel. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Hameichin Metzadeh Gavel.
Amen.
Amen. We're coming to the end of our episode, and we've spoken about so many different strategies, Jewish stories, Jewish rituals, feelings, emotions, the role of communities, the role of Sharon, which is crucial to how communities do their work. But obviously there are some very specific resources out there for everyone in moments of crisis. Lots of support networks of people who are experts who can, as Miriam said, walk alongside in a very practical way. So Sharon, maybe it'd be helpful if you talk us through some of those resources people can turn to, in addition to the ones we've spoken about with the social and the spiritual. But here are some real practical resources.
Yeah, sure. So obviously in an emergency, mental health, like physical health, you can go to A&E, you can call 999 if there's a really urgent situation. And that's really important if somebody's in a crisis. Going to your GP as the gatekeeper, as a first point of contact, also able to self-refer to some community mental health teams and child and adolescent mental health services, CAMHS, for younger people under 18. The number for the Samaritans is 116 123. And I think we're going to have all of this on the links with the podcast, so people can check if they don't have to write all this down. The Jewish Helpline is also a really useful resource on 0800 652 9249. Obviously, Mental Health Shabbat is a Jamie initiative, and Jamie offer an amazing range of services much more nationally now than they did before the pandemic. So wherever you are, you're able to reach out to Jamie and contact them, and they'll be able to advise and support you. There are some really good apps. I think we often talk about social media as having a really negative impact on mental health, but it's really important also to realise the positives. So apps like Quell, Cooth and Shout, and also Me Too, which is M-E-E-T-O-O. They all offer moderated forums and professional support for people. So particularly for people who do feel more comfortable not speaking, perhaps using apps and technology and connecting with other like-minded people, but in a moderated way where there's a professional involved, where we know it's going to be positive for mental health and things that are damaging are taken out. So it's really, really important. And there's some really good apps as well, day-to-day, things like Calm and Headspace, which might help people day-to-day with mindfulness, meditation and things like that, which can be good for mental health. Gratitude diaries. There's an app called Dailyo where people write day-to-day positive things that have happened. So lots of ways we can use social media also to engage in a positive way for our mental health.
Great. Thanks so much, Sharon. And we'll make sure we put all those in the show notes. And you can find, obviously, on jamieuk.org, all of that information as well. Before we finish, maybe let's have one final question, because we've got into the practicalities there. And one of the strategies we have with our mental health is to take perspective, which might be by phoning a friend to talk something through, or going for a walk, or just seeing things through a different light. So maybe we'll take a step back and think about the future of mental health. Where would we like? We've seen the change over the years, as you were talking, Sharon, in your role specifically. Where do we want to be? What's a few, maybe 100 years time? I don't know, like a symbolic moment in the future. What would you like to see that has been transformed in the area of mental health? Debbie, do you feel like kicking us off?
I think we've made so much progress in such a short time. It's kind of almost impossible to imagine what might be in 100 years. But I think for mental health to be discussed and as sort of supported in a way as physical health, that, and sometimes physical health is not supported enough either, so that could also be improved, but that sense that we are whole people with physical health and mental health, and neither of those is, you know, an indication of a good person or a bad person. They are just whole people, and to kind of embrace the wholeness of people, and I suppose have spaces where we can bring that wholeness safely.
Beautiful. Thanks. Miriam?
I'd like us to get to a point where we don't see the kind of binary categories of physical and mental health, but that actually we don't need those different terms. It's just our health and well-being, and that we can present it as one without needing to categorize. And I would love to see a center of well-being at the heart of the Jewish community, in the same way as Jewish Care or Norwood or Jamie are just part of how we function, and that we're able to kind of take their existence for granted because they are so embedded within the Jewish community. I would love to see Wellspring as a new part of that Jewish landscape.
Yeah, amen to that. Sharon, how about you?
I absolutely agree with what Debbie and Miriam have both said. And I also think access to services is really, really important. Mm-hmm. That we talk so much about parity, but for example, things like cancer, at the earliest signs, people get quick pathways to referral. And with mental health, the thresholds are really, really high for accessing services. And why aren't we able to offer people support earlier on in their journey to stop mental health escalating and becoming more impactful and damaging for people's lives? So I do think that access to services is really important. And when people find that voice and the confidence to come forward and say, I need help, to be told there's a really long waiting list and you'll have to wait, or actually you're not bad enough yet, is really, really damaging. And we do see that a lot with young people that we're working with. So that for me would be a really important next step from that parity, that it's the reality in services as well.
Yeah, that's so crucial, isn't it? And I'll add to what you were saying. I mean, the two things I was thinking of in the future of mental health and well-being is, firstly, within the workplace, of really employers really understanding what it means to be human beings, whole human beings, in terms of hours worked, expectations, the need for mental health days, the need for bringing our whole selves, as Debbie said, into that space. And also building on what you said, Sharon, to really understand that, you know, mental health doesn't sit in a silo away over here. It's linked to injustice, it's linked to racism, it's linked to all of the systemic issues we have in society, where we trip over ourselves, we have created these systems that don't work, and mental health and the effect on that is a symptom of the problems that we have. So working on some of those fundamental issues of parity, of justice, of access, so that we can really be a well-held and just society. Amen to all of that. It feels like the world to come is going to be a beautiful one if that's realised. I know we're all working in our own ways to make that a reality as well, which is even more exciting. So I think that's it for this week. I'm going to go and stretch. We'll do what we need to do for our own bodies and beings. And we're going to be back, as usual, 2 weeks from now, maybe developing the themes we've spoken about. I think they're probably themes that we carry in all of our episodes, really. But we're going to talk about a personal growth in time for Tubish Fat. You see what we did there? Growth, trees, branches, leaves, all of that stuff. So until then, have a lovely couple of weeks. Sharon, thank you so much for joining us. Really, you walk alongside us in our jobs, providing so much practical and really emotional support to us in our roles. So thank you. And thank you for having this conversation. It's been a really rich one. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you all next time. Bye.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.